Hello and welcome back. We're here at Microsoft Ignite NZ.
Sunny New Zealand, Seth.
That's right. We're here in springtime, which is fantastic because we're coming out of the ugly fall in Seattle. It's so good to be here with you, my friend.
I think I'll still go skiing this weekend, man. We've got like one weekend left.
Awesome. So I'm here with Chris Auld. Tell us about who you are, what you do now, but we want to get into like the details of the journey. Tell us about who you are.
So I'm the new DX lead for Microsoft New Zealand. So DX, developer experience, the entity previously known as developer and platform evangelism.
Uh-huh.
And I am an evangelist at heart.
Fantastic. So tell us about how you started, because you were telling me stories of like a long time ago of your sort of relationship with Microsoft and its technology, and so you had how you came to this place.
So in my sophomore year at high school, I was lucky enough to win a copy of Windows 95.
How'd you manage that?
I went to a Windows 95 launch event. They had like the Rolling Stones launching Windows 95. So I won this copy of Windows 95. I installed it on my 486 DX266. I think I had a 20 gigabyte hard drive.
Nice.
I was lucky. And that's probably the start of my journey with Microsoft.
So that's interesting because I started like around the same time. I had a DX4100. That was my thing. And I remember, just like you, really excited to install new software. I must have been 14 years old, 15 years old. Tell us about the journey after that, because it's that progress, so that people, if they're interested or excited about.
So I went to university in a place called Dunedin, a traditional university, big covered in ivy sort of
nice.
Carry on.
Yeah.
And I started out studying computer science and management.
Nice.
And I finished neither of them. So about my third weekend, I decided the computer science me. And the undergraduate management just didn't really float my car, doing a thing called information science, which we'd now think of as data science.
Uh-huh.
Way back before it was as trendy as it is now.
Awesome.
And then my dirty little secret, Seth, is I am a trained lawyer.
Oh.
So we can call that my undergraduate degree in sort of management by example of what not to do.
Right.
And argumentation.
Oh, that's awesome. So you went to school in the south of New Zealand. Yeah. You've been in New Zealand your whole life.
I have. So born in New Plymouth. So if you look at New Zealand on the map, it's that little bump on the western side of the North Island.
Mm-hmm.
So born in New Plymouth, school in Whanganui, went down to university in Dunedin. And in the start of my first year of college, I found a job advertised at Student Job Search for an industrial computer program.
Wow. What does that even mean?
Well, so I wrote the systems that that make a whole bunch of sulfuric acid at the fertilizer works.
Wow.
I wrote the systems that make the caramel that goes on top of the Cadbury Morro bars, which are a particularly famous and popular chocolate
That's
bar.
It's kind of like a complete opposite, right? It's like you make sulfuric acid or the chocolate bars. How tasty.
You don't want to mix them up.
No, you don't
want to mix them up. That really plugged me into the developer community. So I was doing a lot of work in VB3, VB4, VB5, VB6.
Right.
In fact, I've still got some friends who work in VB6.
Yeah, still, yeah.
It's still a pretty popular stack. And it meant I got to come to Microsoft TechEd, or what Ignite was called back then. Being a young whippersnapper student, you kind of, as Don Osaka would say, hustle the humans. And so I hustled. I hustled pretty hard and got to know the DX lead back then, a guy called Tony Ward. And he sort of had this genesis for what has gone on to become the Microsoft Student Partner Program. So to basically find some Microsoft advocates amongst the student community.
Sure.
So I sort of put my hand up for that, gave me an Xbox, and I was a really strong and passionate advocate for Microsoft through my time at college.
So you started as an MSP in college then?
I did. So I was a Microsoft, again, it wasn't called that then, because I think there might have been two of us. I think it was only one of us, and that was me.
Wow.
But it's now turned into that MSP program. And the MSPs have been fantastic here.
Yeah, absolutely.
They've been helping out here at Ignite all this week.
Absolutely. We have some wonderful MSPs helping us actually right now. She's smiling at me right now because she knows if it wasn't for her, we'd be a hot mess. Okay, so thanks to the MSPs. And so you were one of the first of that style of sort of partners from Siemens.
Yeah, and then I managed to become an MVP, and okay. I was an MVP for Windows Mobile.
Wow.
Back, you know, if you remember Windows Mobile.
Yeah, the Compaq iPac Plus.
I had the third ever Compaq iPac in New Zealand.
Why?
Behind the two guys at HP New Zealand. You know, and so I was on, and I had a US Robotics Palm Pilot before
oh
that.
Oh my goodness.
Not the Palm Pilot, the US Robotics Palm Pilot.
Oh my goodness. Those are, I'm like, you're like taking me back, because I think we might be around the same age. And so all of the technology that sort of you grew up with, I feel like even though you were literally on the other side of the planet, like our progression through technology was literally the same. And so it's kind of cool to remember.
I mean, it was a pretty cool time.
Yeah.
It was the early days of innovation. It was a little slower.
Sure.
A little more monochrome.
Yeah, monochrome. Yeah.
But it was fun. You know, I mean, I managed my college calendar on my Palm Pilot. Mm-hmm. And now I run my entire life out of Outlook. And I think, you know, a lot of people around the world do.
So tell us a little bit sort of about that transition from MSP to MVP. Was it just like a natural thing that happened when you graduated? Did it happen while you were in college?
It may well have happened while I was. It was around that time. So again, it just comes down to, you know, plugging yourself in aggressively into the community. You know, I was blogging. I was, you know, doing presentations. You know, getting out there and being an active participant in our community. I actually spent some time with all of my MVP peers, because I'm an MVP until the 1st of January.
And yes, because you've got some time. In fact, MVP Summit's coming up pretty soon. Are you gonna be able to go to that?
I'm not, no, that's my first, you know, I've got my first event with partners here in New Zealand. I've got an event that week, unfortunately.
Awesome.
But I got to spend some time with our MVPs having breakfast this morning. You know, it's really great to have a community, you know, a really diverse community of excited people.
So you went from also MVP to RD, and for some reason the RD program is a little fuzzy. So tell us about sort of that transition.
Yes, I mean, if you think about the MVP program, it's often you're quite technically focused. You know, and I was probably somewhat of an exception there in that, you know, I was like a magpie.
Yeah.
I'd go to whatever was shiny. The Microsoft RD program is a much smaller program. So there are a few thousand MVPs. There's about 160 Microsoft regional directors. And the Microsoft regional directors tend to have a broader technology understanding and often tend to be engaging with business folks as much as with technologists. And in some way, we sort of helped to provide some of that bridge from the community back into Microsoft at quite a senior level. So we have a number of very senior execs who sit on the distribution lists that we communicate on.
Right.
You know, and it's a pretty good way for the community to feed reasonably open and honest feedback back into Microsoft.
And I've heard there's times, because I know our CEO sees some of the RD feedback, and I think he met with them at the last build, and they were surprised that a thread came up. He's like, yeah, I saw this thread from the RD list. This is something that's very important to our manager.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Satya, Soma, when he was running DevDiv, Scott. I mean, you know, all those guys, you know, hang out on that list, mm-hmm. and, you know, interact with us. So it's a really neat way for us to help take some of that community feedback back into the mothership.
Awesome. And so then from RD now, you're the DX lead. What does that mean specifically for New Zealand? What's a DX lead do in general and then for New Zealand?
So, I mean, our team is really charged with helping New Zealand organizations, you know, particularly sort of independent software vendors, to build, grow, and really excel with their businesses on top of our Microsoft stack.
Right.
You know, be that Windows, be that Azure, and so forth. So we work really closely with software application developers,
sure.
you know, both small startups and really large organizations, to make sure that they have both sort of technical assistance and business assistance from Microsoft to get the best out of our tech.
So what are some things that DX is going to do with you, obviously in charge here, or does to help them have success? Because obviously we're in an interesting place in technology where we're not getting rid of boxes, we're just replacing them with computer boxes somewhere else. Yep. The days of us unwrapping sort of the shrink-wrapped software that we were so excited to do, we're not going to be putting that into our machines really anymore. What does DX do to help technology or companies here embrace this technology?
So I think one of the interesting things that I've been thinking about, I spent a number of years working in professional services.
Okay.
Not as a lawyer, as a technologist. And it's often been a challenge for professional services firms to make that pivot to being an ISV. Okay. You know, because there's that tension between knocking out chargeable time.
Uh-huh.
And sort of the ISV mission of, you know, selling software often at a much lower margin and supporting that. You know, and as an integrator, it's very easy to, it's easy to sell something twice, because the customer's kind of expecting, you know, lots of hands-on support.
Sure.
And they're prepared to pay for it. It's easy to sell something 100 times because you have the economies of scale.
Sure.
To go and do a full support motion. And then in that fuzzy middle area, it can be challenging because your customer expects boxed software pricing or SaaS software pricing.
Sure, sure.
But you may not have the scale to support it. And I think one of the things that the cloud's letting us do is lower that barrier, lower that support barrier, lower the sort of the management and operationalization barrier, which means that more integrators are going to be able to take the IP that they build up in their businesses and in the engagements with their clients and take that out to market.
That's an interesting perspective that maybe I haven't heard, you know, that much, because most self-funded sort of groups that eventually become ISVs almost always start out as consultants. And they find that there's this thing that they're doing over and over, and they try to weaponize it, so to speak, and productize it. And there is this weird gap.
Yeah,
right?
It's challenging.
And so what are some things, like, let's just say someone's watching right now in New Zealand, they're like, hey, like, I feel you. I'm in this weird gap where we're half, like, we have some guys and gals doing some consulting, and we have some guys and gals making this product. How do you move sort of into that sort of lower cost software, lower margin, but more volume? How do you do that? What are some things that they can do to do that?
You know, so, I mean, come and have a chat with our team. You know, let us help explain to you a little bit about BizTalk and some of the incubation programs that we offer to help you take advantage of our platform. You know, we're also quite focused on really supporting that ISV ecosystem across all of the subsidiary businesses around the world.
Right.
So having, you know, our Microsoft salespeople who engage with customers, making sure that they have an understanding of ISV solutions, making sure that they have an understanding of the sorts of fantastic tech that we've got built on top of Azure, built on top of Office 365 that they can take into their customers to use.
And I like that approach, right? Because there's no way to do a general prescription across all ISVs because they're all doing different things. They might have a range of different products that they may be able to use. Now, is this assistance that they're going to get something that we're just going to go do? Is it consulting? Is that part of it? Or is there just someone going to show up and be like, hey, think about it this way?
It really is. It's advice, yeah. You know. So we've got both business and technically focused folks in our team who can help with advice, help to make connections, you know, into Microsoft and into other organisations who we work with in the New Zealand community. You know,
sure.
Startups, incubators, and so forth.
So if you have any questions, please submit them below. We're going to take as many questions as we can, so make sure you get those in. And as we transition a little bit into sort of New Zealand, I love how you're talking about sort of what DX does. I'm also a part of DX, if you may or may not know. Tell us a little bit about how long you've been here in New Zealand, what it means to you, what are some of the technologies, what are some of the spaces, verticals that sort of exist here that could benefit from these kind of transformations?
So, I mean, I've been the chief technology officer of a company called Intergen. So we would be, you know, probably the largest of the Microsoft-focused integrators in New Zealand. And I was a major shareholder in that business. So,
yeah.
So you know, after college, I built a company building applications on Windows Mobile.
Nice.
Sold that to Intergen in effectively an equity swap transaction. And then we built Intergen from about 150 people when I joined to about 450 when we sold it to a listed Australian firm. And during my time at Intergen, I continue to build our close relationship to Microsoft. So we built up a business actually based up in Redmond that does a lot of work for Microsoft, building up many of their sort of early adopter training content and many of the big keynote demos that you'll see at big events. So if you go to one of the big 10 to 20,000 person Microsoft events around the globe, there's a pretty good chance that we've built one or more of the big technology showcase demos that they use at that event. And you know, I sort of incubated that business on the long haul commute, you know, flying back and forth between here and Seattle. And then we started an office there, and I spent the last 12 months actually physically living in wow. Redmond, awesome. Running that office. So
you have a sense for what it takes to go from idea to ISV to even in more companies. And so that experience, how does that inform, that experience inform sort of what you tell other companies when they're trying to make that transition?
I mean, I think for me, it's been able to bring both a technical understanding as well as a business understanding. You know, far too often as technologists, we can have a fantastic idea, build a fantastic product, and actually not understand that the hard bits go in selling that. You know, and so we've had some opportunities as part of Intergen to spin out some businesses. You know, so we spun a business out called we spun a business out called Action This that was a task management application for Microsoft Outlook.
Yeah.
And that was not successful. But as part of building Action This prior to the cloud and running and hosting Action This from down here in New Zealand, we ran into performance challenges. So we built some performance optimization tools for Action This.
Awesome.
That ultimately turned into another company called Aptimize. We raised some angel funding into that, built that business, and then sold it to a company that's on the NASDAQ called Riverbed.
Awesome.
So that was pretty neat. We've actually rolled a couple of other businesses out of Intergen as well. So I've got an understanding of the tech. I mean, I am a technical person.
Right.
But actually a bit of a business understanding. So what's it like to go and raise capital? What are investors going to be asking? You know, how do you make sure that you have an investable proposition?
So you are also involved in New Zealand, specifically where you live. Tell us about sort of your involvement in sort of New Zealand itself. Tell us about that.
So I when I went to high school, I was an enthusiastic whitewater kayaker and a mad keen mountain biker. And,
nice.
We used to, one of my fantastic school teachers used to drive us from Whanganui to Rotorua to go kayaking. And sometime again, you know, that sophomore year of high school, I decided at some point I wanted to live in Rotorua. Rotorua is about 2 hours south of our largest city, Auckland.
Right.
Be top five place in the world for mountain biking. There's amazing whitewater kayaking, fishing, and so forth. And so about 5 years ago, I had the opportunity to actually move there. So I bought a house in Rotorua. It's a fantastic place on the lake, you know, wonderful and pretty damn cheap.
Yeah.
You know, and I was able to, you know, go and live in the place that I'd always wanted to. And, you know, I think that one of the things about technology is that it unlocks opportunities for us to grow our regions in New Zealand.
Right.
If we look at New Zealand and we think about, you know, what is our comparative advantage, right? We grow fantastic grass and therefore feed all our dairy cows and make great milk and cheese and dairy products and so
and
forth.
And there's a lot of sheep everywhere.
And it's a place that people really want to live. And to take full advantage of that lifestyle comparative advantage, we need to make sure that we equip and grow our regions. And so another thing that I'm going to be really focused on with our team here at DX New Zealand is making sure that we are looking to unlock opportunities for people to build these software businesses around the whole of New Zealand.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing. I was recently, a couple months ago in South America, where perhaps they don't have many of the economic opportunities, but the cloud has lowered the barrier to entry, not just for those that are maybe don't have as much economy, but even for those that maybe locationally feel disadvantaged because they're far out. Tell us about New Zealand as a whole. What are sort of the industries that people, if they're in, can take advantage of the technology that we're discussing?
I mean, I think a place that we've not taken as much advantage of technology as we could is in tourism. So, you know, obviously our big sectors are dairy and, yeah. and agriculture, horticulture, more generally primary production, and tourism. And I think there's huge opportunity to think about tourism and the way that we can bring technology to tourism. One of the people in our keynote this week, Angie Judge, from a company called Digzibit. So they're building a fantastic business. And I've seen Angie grow her business from startup, right, to now, you know, landing in some pretty big global museums. So they've taken technology into the museum tourism area.
That's awesome.
And they've been able to do that from New Zealand because the cloud doesn't just lower the barrier to entry, it lowers the barrier to explosive growth.
Right.
You know, and that was always the, it means that you can be far more capital efficient. And when you think about funding your business, you know, equity is the most expensive form of capital. You know,
sure.
I do a little bit of angel investing, and you know, an angel and a VC expects a large return. Equity is the most expensive form of capital. So being able to lower those capital requirements in the early stages of your business as you prove it out and as you take those first sort of explosive growth steps, lets you retain a bit more control.
Yeah.
Lets you retain a bit more of the upside.
And it also lets you retain sort of your ability to be where you want to be, do what you want to do. And so it's sort of a democratization, so to speak, of technology. Yeah.
And so I'm actually lucky enough to, I sit as one of the board directors of the Rotorua Economic Development and Tourism Organization. So our district council has unified its subsidiary organizations that look after economic development and tourism, because we are really a tourism destination. And the thing that really interests me about that is the opportunity to A, grow the regions, but also to reach out and help people grow businesses in some of our, you know, our less privileged communities.
Sure.
Rotorua has got a large population of people who, you know, may not have done so well economically over the years.
Sure.
And I think there's a huge opportunity again for us to use technology to help them realize their potential.
That's amazing. And I think obviously our mantra, it's on our name badge, it's on our badges, is to empower every person and every organization on the planet to achieve more. Let's talk a little bit now. We have about maybe 10 minutes left. What are some of the technologies that you're most excited about that Microsoft makes that are going to enable this transformation?
Yeah, so let's riff on some. You know, I think some of the stuff we showed in the keynote, the cognitive APIs.
Right.
So the cognitive machine learning sort of it's blown up, right?
Yeah.
I did machine learning back in the 90s. You know, I often joke I've been doing machine learning since R was S.
Because
you know, funnily enough, the R programming language grew out of Auckland University.
That's right.
Robert E. Harker, Robert Gentleman. So
that
you know,
is right.
You know, pretty close to my heart, and obviously, you know, pretty neat to have something come out of New Zealand. So machine learning is blown up, but the cognitive APIs are interesting to the extent that they really are only something that could be built by an organization like Microsoft.
Of course.
So they are pre-trained machine learning models trained on an utterly enormous corpus of data.
Like a ridiculous.
Right. And the only way you can get that enormous corpus of data is if you run one of the global search engines. And,
right.
You know, there's probably only a couple of folks
probably
doing
right.
that. You know, so, you know, taking that corpus of data plus being a hyperscale cloud provider, that really is, what it does is it gives developers access to the value of that stored data,
sure.
You know, to APIs that are able to deal with natural language processing, that have understood how we communicate by observing the real world.
Yeah, and what's amazing is that this sort of trove of knowledge, we're sort of, again, like weaponizing or productizing in a way that anyone can use it. Have you seen anyone use these cognitive APIs to great success, or is there something that you envision with these things happening in the future?
You know, again, if we talk about the power of technology to really change people's lives, so one of the examples that we showed in the keynote, in fact, you know, Nigel Parker, who ran DX in New Zealand prior to me, showed it in his demo, is the use of the cognitive image processing API,
right,
to help people with blindness. So the ability to include that in some sort of wearable device. In this case, they were using wearable glasses, and then stream that content to the cloud, process the content in the cloud, and then stream back information about what's seen in the image.
Right.
And, you know, and again, by virtue of having trained these APIs on such an enormous corpus of data, we end up with a very, very powerful solution that, that can literally look at things in the real world, understand what they are, and be able to read that back to that person. So that's pretty neat.
And I love the idea, like Satya in some of the keynotes and the Ignite in the United States and some others has been talking about the democratization of artificial intelligence. How does cognitive services sort of help push forward the idea that machine learning and AI is for everybody?
I mean, data scientists are like rocking horse poop. very, very hard to find.
Yeah.
but in fact, I do actually have a couple of pointers here. The way that the cognitive API is democratized is twofold. One is it's much easier to consume.
Of course.
You know, so you actually don't need to understand the mechanics of how to build and train a machine learning model. But sure. Two, it provides people with access to the value of that massive data set.
Right.
You know, which again is something that really, you know, only a couple of organizations in the world have in their sort of power to be able to work with. If we go back to my rocking horse poo.
Yeah. Love it.
I often talk to people about, you know, I think data science is a capability that's important to build inside your organization. It's not something you should outsource.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately your data scientist needs to understand the nature of your business. But there are some opportunities to go and find data scientists from unusual places. You know, if you want to build data science tools, you need to go and hire folks out of top computer science faculties.
Sure.
If you want to hire people to do data science, you should go and find people inside academia who have been using the tools of data science. You need to go and look at the life sciences, at biological sciences, at zoology, psychology.
Geneticists have been doing psychology.
People who understand the experimental method,
yeah.
Right? And people who understand actually how to use these tools in anger with real data sets. And there's a huge opportunity, again, for us as technologists, because we've got a kick-ass industry, right?
Yeah.
We've got great jobs, they pay really well, you know, freedom, it's exciting. There's a whole lot of people, right, with backgrounds in working with data that we can go and tap and, you know, and give an opportunity to work in our industry.
I love it. So we have about maybe 5 or so minutes left. They're telling me 4 minutes left.
Four minutes.
What are some things, some takeaways that you want people that are watching take away about sort of what New Zealand is doing, how they can sort of use technology to better sort of everything that's going on in agriculture and tourism?
Yeah.
And then secondly, what are some things that people can do to sort of start riding this wave of technology? Yeah.
So, I mean, we are a fantastic place to live and work.
I would have to agree with that. It's fantastic here, you guys.
And we are building amazing businesses, you know, from down here in New Zealand. You know, we want more people to come and live and work and enjoy our country. You know? So if you're out there and that appeals, you know, look into it. You know, for folks who are looking at building a business, uh-huh. You know, make sure that you understand both the technology and the business model and the business pathway that you're going to have to follow. Stand on the shoulders of giants. You know, we've had some extremely successful ISV businesses start and grow here in New Zealand, you know, on top of the Microsoft technology stack. So go and meet those people, hustle them. You know, we're all a pretty friendly bunch.
Yeah, it's quite true.
You know,
yeah.
And we've grown great businesses from around New Zealand. You know, I know of some fantastic businesses here in Auckland, Tauranga, Wellington, Christchurch, Dunedin, New Plymouth, Masterton. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some amazing stuff going on in Masterton. You know, there are pockets of people who are just waiting to share their stories and help other Kiwi entrepreneurs out.
Awesome. Last thing, if someone were to visit New Zealand, what is something that they just absolutely have to do and see? Maybe a couple.
Something you have to go and see. So, I mean, I'll obviously give you one from my hometown of Rotorua. So there's an organization down there called Canopy Tours.
Okay.
You know, in fact, one of my good friends is the lead guide at Canopy Tours. And they have built an eco-friendly zipline operation through the native rainforest of New Zealand. But as well as that, they've taken this forest area under their wing, and they're working on eradicating pests and so forth. So it's fantastic to go and do that, but also to get an understanding of the nature of our ecosystem and the work that we still have to do, you know, to make sure that we really look after the world that we live in. You know, so I'd go and look at Canopy Tours, and maybe if you're still into adrenaline after that, I would go and do the whitewater rafting down the Kaituna River, the highest commercially rafted waterfall, and might I add 10 minutes from my house.
Awesome.
Which will give you a thrill. It's about a 40-minute trip. It's really warm. It's just beautiful. And again, through an amazing slot canyon with our native forest over the top.
Awesome. Well, we're all coming over. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. It was awesome to learn about New Zealand and what we're doing here. We're going to go to the session right now.